Silber's ending is emotionally shattering despite its tender wisdom and resignation. It is difficult to discern how it manages this powerful effect, except that emotion has been building throughout, then carefully set aside for subsequent artful triggering. An effect I've experienced at the end of only a few other novels, Alison Lurie's Foreign Affairs, say, or J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace. A novel in stories, Silber's book proves, is not a cheat. Done right, it is a kind of double major, accomplishing two difficult things simultaneously, singing an aria while building a house. Human existence is not tragic, both these activities proclaim, but it is fragmented, improvisational, dangerous, accidental, maddening, and funny. Despite the tears, it is a roadrunner and wily coyote cartoon of desire and its object. It is a Buddhist comedy of the self attempting to remove the self. The core of life, as Silber demonstrates throughout her work and states explicitly in her very first book, is tyrannically physical. The mind has a few nifty tricks for forgetting pain, as does the body, while it simultaneously attempts to learn from history, its own and others, if this is at all possible. Is it? Silber swims through and past all of these heavenly ideas, a graceful swimmer on a leisurely swim, though her brisk, radiant prose chops the water like a sprite. 2005. Eudora Welty. 16 years ago, I was in Jackson, Mississippi, and the owner of the bed and breakfast at which I was staying gave me Eudora Welty's address at 1119 Pinehurst Street, across from Belhaven College. Miss Welty loves visitors, I was told, and I should feel free and welcome to go knock on her door. I was surprised that Welty was being openly offered up this way as a public site to a casual tourist fresh from Faulkner's Roanoke. For a minute I saw Welty as perhaps a kind of political prisoner, held hostage by Southern graciousness, perhaps even the Jackson Chamber of Commerce, for I knew that no writer in her writer's heart welcomes impromptu visits from people she doesn't know. But a writer's heart is often dressed up in the local protective coloring of her address, and no writer is entirely a writer. She is also many other things. But the writer part, the accident of mind that prompts the private secreting away of phrases and ideas, is never understood the way a neighborhood might imagine, because it is never really glimpsed, though this is seldom acknowledged. I was once also in Baltimore the year Anne Tyler won the Pulitzer Prize. Tyler was a Welty devotee and the first to interview her at length in the New York Times. Two journalists recounted that they had knocked on Tyler's front door to get her response to winning the prize and that, unlike Welty, she had sent them away with a brusque, "I'm sorry, I'm working right now." I expressed amazement that Tyler had opened her door at all. Surely that was the southern part of her, hospitality opening it, but the midwestern part. The Midwest, erroneously known for its friendliness, is natively skeptical of open arms and excellent manners, had declined a visit. Personally, living in the Midwest, if I saw strangers approaching my door, I would probably phone 911. Despite two Southern grandfathers and a childhood during which I was told I was half Southern, it is quite possible I do not have a Southern bone in my body. Nonetheless, 16 years ago, clutching directions, I did scout out Welty's house, and though I would never have been so low down as to have gotten out of the car, like the most craven sort of paparazzi, I stopped long enough to lean out the window and take a picture of the house, a spacious faux Tudor set back from the curb on a long cared-for lawn, and then I rolled away, wondering if I'd seen the front curtains move. When I returned from my trip, I pasted the photo in a scrapbook. That Welty had charismatic friendliness in abundance, her combination of shyness and gregariousness won over everyone, was never in her lifetime in doubt. She was a natural storyteller, a wit, and a clown. "If this sofa could talk," she said once to Reynold Price, looking at the bedraggled plastic furnishings of the only rental room Price could find for them in Tuscaloosa, "we would have to burn it." All of Welty's endearing qualities were underscored by Suzanne Mars's recent biography of her, the only one ever authorized by Welty. An unauthorized one appeared in 1998, Eudora, A Writer's Life by Anne Waldron, who, without Welty's approval, began to feel shunned by Welty's fiercely protective friends and a bit sorry for herself, perceiving that she was rather literally disapproved of, the perennially uninvited guest. Welty, at the time of Waldron's completed book, was 89 and unable to read for long spells. "Thank goodness," suggests Jacksonian Mars, the anointed biographer. Still, despite the biblical saying, "a prophet is not often without honor in her own country," Welty was a goddess in Jackson. What a prophet is often without is privacy, peace, and any real depth of comprehension among her fellow citizens. And although this is not the task or accomplishment of literary biography, that Suzanne Mars has waited until after Welty's death to publish Eudora Welty is certainly a beginning to all three. It is also a work of love, as biographies often have to be, just to get written. But of course, unlike with a work of disinterested investigation, there can be problems. A work of love may suddenly turn, in exhaustion, upon its subject. It may never look hard in certain corners out of fear of risking itself. It can grow defensive or caressing. Still, literary biography has its practitioners, and even more so, its readers, some looking for instruction, some looking for secrets, some simply curious to discover how a life can be lived one way on the outside and yet another way on the inside, without derailing and tumbling into madness. Some wanting to see if that contradiction is, as Flaubert, another writer who lived with his mother, famously suggested, the very thing that keeps sanity in place. Or if the safe living that ensures the daring art is also what keeps the grown-up a child, or a community pet, or unhappy, or drunk. The element that is most often looked for by both biographer and reader, however, is how the life is revealed in the work, and so the work is read backward, as a source for the life. And the misstep of biographical overreading begins to mar, so to speak, the discussion of the work. I'm afraid this is sometimes done so blithely in Suzanne Mars's book that, leaving no room for the beautiful deformities of invention, she actually refers to one character, Courtney, in an early story of Welty's as A.K.A. Eudora, as if a fictional character were in alias or someone the author is doing business as. Oh well, it is a hazard of literary biography that few have avoided. Still, the phrase A.K.A. Eudora, it seems to me, sets a new rhetorical standard for refusal even to try. This aside, Mars's biography, with its access to documents, friends, and the subject herself, inevitably proves an interesting and engaging addition to our understanding of Welty, and to a lesser extent, Welty's great ear for the voices and stories of Southern life. Whether it be a poor black woman shooing animals from her path at Christmas time, or a white murderer mired in folksy hate, it is also an explicit and sharp retort to Waldron's earlier biography and to the criticisms leveled by Claudia Roth Pierpont in a 1999 New Yorker article. The former work, though sympathetic and vividly written, is scattered with gossipy quotes, several about Welty's supposed physical unattractiveness. The latter took Welty to task for politely turning her back on the subject of race in Mississippi, allegedly to ingratiate herself socially with Jackson insiders. Mars's book takes on a defensive tone as she attempts to offer correctives. To counter the latter, she leans heavily on a quote by Toni Morrison that Welty wrote about black people in a way that few white men have ever been able to write, It's not patronizing, not romanticizing. It's the way they should be written about. And offers up Welty's few friendships with African Americans, most of whom were her caretakers in her old age. To counter the former, Mars offers descriptions of Welty's large and luminous eyes. It is interesting that Mars's best potential counter-arguments to each lie in photography. Welty was hardly unattractive. She was tall, thin, and in photo after photo bears a striking resemblance to the musician Joni Mitchell. Welty's occasional relationship with black people, as glimpsed in her stunning collection of Depression-era photographs, One Time, One Place, 1971, was warm and interested, the gazes of her subjects often meeting her halfway, in the middle distance between the camera and the photograph, as if to say they understand this strange white lady with her camera, that she is not just benign, but perhaps in her open curiosity, good-humored and good-hearted as well. There is mutual trust, no mutual fear. For many of her subjects, this was the first picture ever taken of them. Whatever you might think of those lives as symbols of a bad time, wrote Welty, the human beings who were living them thought a good deal more of them than that. These photographs part a curtain of indifference to each other's presence, each other's wonder, each other's human plight, she wrote in 1971, just 8 years after she had declined to be interviewed on television by Ralph Ellison for the fear of trouble and hostility an interview by a black man might stir up for her and her mother. In the massive correspondence available for research, writes Mars, Eudora used the word nigger 4 times as a descriptor. 4? Such an unrousing defense counters Pierpont's hypothesis far less well than a simple look at what Welty did with an inexpensive camera that her father had bequeathed her. Welty was born in 1909, the oldest of 3 children, and the only daughter of a strong-willed Appalachian woman and an insurance man from Ohio. Recently moved to the burgeoning town of Jackson to take a position with the Lamar Life Insurance Company. Welty's parents had met when her father had a summer job in a logging camp near her mother's West Virginia home. Welty had her father's affable face and his interest in photography. From her mother, she inherited a passion for reading. Though she rebelliously rejected her mother's beloved Dickens and also failed to read Middlemarch until she was 65. She loved Wolfe, Austen, and S.J. Perlman. To Wolfe, she once wrote a rather nervy fan letter in which she declared that Bernard, in The Waves, was an unworthy medium for Wolfe's genius. Of To the Lighthouse, which she loved, she wrote to Wolfe, "It dissolved all the sediment of loneliness of my dull days into a perfect amorphous stream of motion and intensity that flows clear and penetrative over the mosaic of my imagination, or perhaps yours. It was a light under a door I shall never open." Of Austen, Welty wrote, as if of her own work, "How could it be possible for these novels to seem remote? For one thing, the noise. What a commotion comes out of their pages." As a published writer, she also wrote to Perlman, whom she had revered and imitated when younger, and he wrote her back, "I hope you won't think I'm being unduly familiar when I ask for permission to kiss the hem of your expensive garment, but I'm an obscure member of the Welty Fan Club, whose other name, I understand, is Legion. Another paid-up member, he asks me to inform you, is Ogden Nash. None of this will pay your grocer's bill, I admit, but it may stave off boredom." As a schoolgirl, she was a popular, if sheltered, child, close with her brothers. Funny, theatrical, she was voted best all-round girl by her high school senior class. That she graduated from high school the same year Richard Wright graduated valedictorian from the black high school in segregated Jackson seems astonishing, as does the fact that Wright and Welty, even later, never once met. She went off to college to become an artist of some sort, first to the Mississippi State College for Women, where to a friend she said of the daily prayer meetings, "The way it makes me feel is what I call hell." Then to Randolph Macon, which she left, when they wouldn't take all her transfer credits, for the University of Wisconsin in Madison. A friend from Jackson wrote her at the time, "You have become quite a will-o'-the-wisp. I read in the paper where you are off for Randolph Macon, Ward, Belmont, or some such place, and then comes a post from Wisconsin, in gleeful vein, narrating how you are an art student in the beer-drinking country." The displaced Welty found Wisconsinites cold and flinty. But she fell under the spell of a young 18th-century literature professor, Ricardo Quintana, who exists now in the corridors of the Wisconsin English Department as a small reading room and a named professorship. And in between experiments with bathtub gin and needle beer, a corked non-alcoholic beer into which raw alcohol was inserted with a syringe, this was prohibition in beer country, she became his most brilliant student, whether he knew this or not. After graduating from Wisconsin, she enrolled in an advertising secretarial program at Columbia, and there began her long, complicated love affair with New York City. It is both amusing and heartbreaking to read the spirited and desperately humorous letters of application that Welty sent out to The New Yorker, to Scribner's, to National Geographic, begging for any sort of job. "I am a Southerner from Mississippi, the nation's most backward state," she wrote in one. "How I would like to work for you." She longed to stay in New York, though her mother was calling her home, her father was dying, and her attempts to find desirable work, even after her father died and she went back to the city again to pound the pavement, all failed. Later in life, she would spend summers in New York writing book reviews for the Times under a pseudonym. Back home, though her writing progressed, she began to write short stories, and they began to be published, first in Manuscript Magazine, then later in the Atlantic Monthly and Harper's. She was often sick of Jackson, and her young adulthood seems to have alternated between productive spells of home life and flurries of ineffectual attempts to get out. "I feel like burning the Clarion Ledger every morning," she wrote in one letter. "Well, I just won't go into it. And the legislature, a disgrace every day. And altogether, Mississippi seems to get more hopeless all the time. Jeez. The other day a bill was proposed whereby anybody, who didn't like Mississippi could get a free ticket out of it, the state to provide the RR fare and a $10 bill to spend when you've got out. Hooray, I'll be the first one. I'll go somewhere nice and be a 20-minute queen." By this time, however, she was more than a little in love with a Jacksonian, John Robinson. He was also a writer. With Welty's help, he had a story published in The New Yorker before she ever did, though more uncertain in his talent and ambition, and she had known him for years and corresponded with him throughout his military service in Africa and Italy during the war. She retained lifelong contact with him, and for long stretches they were close. Welty's 1946 novel, Delta Wedding, is dedicated to him and uses historical material about his local ancestors, which he provided. Robinson's homosexuality, however, would eventually make her see that intimate romance was impossible. She had a gift for friendship, but was not lucky in love. Another romantic infatuation came later in life, one with the married Ken Millar, a detective novelist who wrote famously and successfully under the name Ross MacDonald. She was probably seduced by Elizabeth Bowen on a trip she took to Ireland in 1950. One particular Welty letter strongly suggests it, and she remained good friends with Bowen until Bowen's death. But Mars takes great pains to dispel any idea that Welty was a lesbian. If the lady doth protest too much, it seems that this is part of the task of the authorized biography. Rumor dismissal, perhaps even counterintelligence. But it does seem clear that although she had many gay friends, male and female, Welty, like so many other women writers, had a predilection for the handsome, literary, unavailable man, though Elizabeth Bowen, it will be noted, was often said to resemble just that. Elsewhere, Mars's biography becomes pretty much a rat-a-tat-tat of Welty's many publications, trips, parties, and dinners. Welty seemed to love any populated room that did not have Carson McCullers in it. McCullers was notoriously disliked by many. In trying to combat the image of Welty as a reclusive spinster, Mars may have erred in the other direction, making Eudora, as both she and Waldron call her, seem tirelessly social, a rollicking holly-go-welty, dining with the David Rockefellers, sailing off to Europe. Mars's book can seem a reaction formation to such comments as this from the president of Dartmouth, who said rather humiliatingly of Welty while bestowing on her an honor. Eudora Welty has taught us that we have worlds to learn from a woman who has never married, who has rarely traveled, and who still lives in the home in which she spent her childhood. In response, Mars recounts high-spirited sojourns in Mexico and New Orleans, mining them for every vaguely wild moment or slight adventure they contain. Details from party games are included, as if their fun could possibly be discerned from this vantage point. Once Welty's career is well underway, a peripatetic existence takes hold, and a typical Mars passage reads, "From New York, Eudora went first to the University of Tennessee, then to Kenyon College for her 23rd honorary degree, and a reunion with old friend Robert Daniel. After a brief stop at home, she headed to Memphis for her 24th honorary degree, this one from Southwestern College, and then to Washington." Who is Robert Daniel again? We have forgotten. Mars presents Welty, probably inadvertently, as a girl who could not say no to any social obligation, speaking invitation, or tedious award. Welty once even gave a reading at the Citadel. "I'm considering giving my reading in Confederate dress with sword gestures," she joked. She even spoke at the California high school graduation of the daughter of a former Miss Mississippi, because she was asked. This generosity became well known and perhaps exploited. Even Mars requested that Welty come speak to her undergraduates at Millsaps. Welty had little peace, though also often didn't seem expressly to desire any. Having, as a young writer, befriended two literary grand dames, Catherine Ann Porter and Bowen, she gamely stepped forward when her turn came. And there was a bit of the actress in her, she had won accolades in high school plays, which she could summon and which would often get her through. Naturally modest, however, she often felt honoraried to death. Only her friends William Maxwell and Reynolds Price are on the record as being concerned for her on this matter. At times, it seems, she was using prizes and readings the way Melville used whaling ships, as a way to see the world. But it was not successful. She was pestered, and her writing languished. The more awards, which included 39 honorary doctorates, she received, with little new writing coming forth, the more ridiculous and depressed she sometimes felt. Once, when she was away, a thief broke into her Jackson home and made off with her typewriter, instruction manual, seat cushion, and gold membership pin from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. "He's sitting at my typewriter now, on my cushion, writing and wearing my pin," Welty joked. She suffered two substantial bouts of writer's block. Though this condition may have been indistinguishable from fatigue at nursing her ill mother, the upsetting early deaths of her brothers and father, painful arthritis in her hands, the death of her longtime agent, Dermot Russell, and the general loss of good friends, almost all of whom she outlived. In addition to her photography, which surely will endure, Welty will be remembered for a handful of writings, which is really all any writer, even a great one, can hope for. The less ambitious of the novels, the exquisitely grief-stricken The Optimist's Daughter, which movingly dramatizes the loneliness of a young woman who has outlived everyone she loves, Surviving is perhaps the strangest fantasy of them all, she thinks. And possibly even the Ponder Heart may also be her most successful, and with their delicate melancholy and quick, dark hilarity, they seem of a piece with her most accomplished short stories. Each of these slender novels possesses the structure and theatricality of a play, and The Ponder Heart did in fact become a Broadway hit, with its tart and lively voices, "He loved happiness like I love tea." It seems a natural outgrowth of the earlier Why I Live at the P.O., Welty's comic masterpiece, which in its spritzing monologue about sibling rivalry cleverly updates and transforms the parable of the prodigal son. "She's always had anything in the world she wanted, and then she'd throw it away," fumes the jealous sister and narrator of Why I Live at the P.O., who has cleared out of her house in righteous indignation to live at the post office where she works. "Papa Daddy gave her this gorgeous add-a-pearl necklace when she was 8 years old, and she threw it away playing baseball when she was 9, with only 2 pearls. This biblical fracturing and reconstruction is an aspect of the story neither of her biographers mentions, though what is mentioned is that the email software system Eudora was named after Welty because its inventor felt that while developing it, he was living at the P.O. In another very different story, No Place for You, My Love, in which 2 dislocated strangers in New Orleans take up with each other for a mysterious afternoon, we can not only experience another end of Welty's interesting range, which roams from vernacular shtick to Chekhovian zen, but in its comic tragic vision of the fateful and moody visitations of love, feel an influence cast forward to the stories of Alice Munro and Richard Ford, both of whose work explores the sudden crossings of erotic lines by characters who proceed without much explanation, but with private clarity and spiritual adventure. This story, along with Why I Live at the P.O., and perhaps A Worn Path and The Petrified Man as well, seems likely for the long haul, as it is determined by the canon-making mechanisms of story anthologies. Another currently anthologized one, Powerhouse, may not. Despite its intentions to honor Fats Waller, it is so off-puttingly laced with racial clichés that it may have difficulty being understood as Welty or Mars would have it be, as an homage deliberately constructed from the white prejudice all black musicians faced. "And his mouth is going every minute, like a monkey's when it looks for something. Big arched eyebrows that never stop traveling, like a Jew's, wandering Jew eyebrows." Reading Powerhouse today is uncomfortable and baffling. Welty's own brief autobiography, The Lovely One Writer's Beginnings, was her best-selling book, and may continue to be. Money she made from it, she offered repeatedly to friends who were sick. In its pages, she speaks of finding the nickels that were laid upon the eyes of a baby sister who had died before Welty was born, nickels Welty was forbidden to take. These nickels, containing both life and death, are like Welty's stories themselves, treasures lifted from the pockets of the living and the faces of the dead, unspendable objects of both lightness and density, invested with largeness while remaining unsweetly small. In trying to get her work published in New York, the young Welty boarded many a train with high hopes and $100, which she could make last 2 days, theater included. Editors might heap her with praise and still say no. "All this," she wrote, "would go on the train with me, up there and back. It was part of my flying landscape." Mars's biography piques our interest in the contemporary writers Welty herself so valued. V.S. Pritchett, whose story she esteemed above any other living writers, her mentor Catherine Ann Porter, whose beautiful prose style and difficult personality prompted Welty to worry that Porter's perfectionist tinkering was life-robbing, risking the creation of a lovely casket of a book and, as some have said, of a person. Reynolds Price, who was like an adored son to her and who seems, in Mars's pages, adorable, and Welty Muse and Inamorato, Ken Millar, whose detective novels one is inclined now more than ever to investigate. The eye of the story is dedicated to him. If there are minor faults in Mars's biography, how not in a book so teeming with detail? Nonetheless, even a trivial misrepresentation can rattle a reader's faith. One example here might be Mars's characterization of the Hôtel de Saint-Père, where Welty stayed in Paris, as shabby. This seems Mars once again combating Welty's image as a perfect lady and straining to present her as a bohemian, slumming on the left bank, when in fact Welty continually stayed at very nice places when she traveled, and the Hôtel de Saint-Père, last I looked, is one, just as it was when Edna Millay lived there in the 1920s. Another may be the delayed mention of Welty's height, which comes so late in the biography that it is startling. Welty was 5'10", though osteoporosis eventually shrank her to 5'3". If there are larger problems in the book, one might be Mars's very gingerly handling of Welty's relationship with her mother, Chestina, which was assumed by many to be stormy. After a stroke, the first thing Chestina said to her daughter when she was able to speak in a tiny voice was that the doctor was a moron. Chestina, in fact, emerges more clearly in Waldron's unauthorized biography than in Mars's authorized one. As the mother-daughter correspondence cannot be made available for another 15 years, someone is waiting for the grandchildren to die? Welty's mother remains an elusive figure, controlling, snobbish, perhaps racist in the few glimpses we get of her, and Welty would necessarily have been at odds with her when young and more forgiving later on. As Welty wrote in The Optimist's Daughter, "Is there any sleeping person you can be entirely sure you have not misjudged?" Henry Green, another writer Welty greatly admired, once wrote to her in warning, "Don't forget about aged parents. They are fiends." Welty would not have been thrilled with any biography, and even for an authorized biographer, her desire to retain an inner self that is a deep black hiding place makes her a difficult subject. She was not brave politically. She was suspicious of groupthink of any sort, whether it contained southern benightedness or northern sanctimoniousness, and in the essay, "Must the Writer Crusade?" the exasperated title speaks for itself. She dismissed feminism as noisiness, and once, when asked whether she'd been brought up to believe a woman's place was in the home, she replied, "I don't think I was ever told where it was." She felt she was already writing about injustice of various kinds. She voted Democratic. That should be enough. Any whiff of Yankee bias irked her, and she was rightly suspicious of the literary term regionalism, though her friend, V.S. Pritchett, in a review of The Ponderheart, defended the traditions of regional writing, saying, "They are a protest by old communities, enriched by wounds, against the success of mass or polyglot culture." Even in her own work, moreover, Welty wrote, "How did it leave us? The old, safe, slow way people used to know of learning how one another feels." This from the point of view of a northern character having lunch at Galatoire's. In the very same story, southernness is seen as the less naive stance, a look, a mask of life-as-a-dream irony which could turn to pure challenge at the drop of a hat. In letters Welty wrote, especially toward the end of her life, she said she often dreamed in galley proofs, and the struggle of the dream consisted of trying to make corrections on the type. She wrote at a desk with her back to the window, the quiet cruise and trespass of tourists insufficiently obscured outside. If her life had fallen into a trap or two, well, the world is full of traps of all sorts, and one can find some writer or other in each and every one of them. Literary biography is like detective fiction, for those who don't need suspense. 2006. Alice Munro's The Moons of Jupiter. Jupiter was the first planet studied by Galileo, in whose telescope were discovered Jupiter's four largest moons as well. Now there are over 60 known moons whose presences have revealed themselves, like Alice Munro's work, shyly opening up over the years. But these first four moons are referred to as the Galilean ones, and they are named after mortals favored by the great god Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, whose lives are forever altered by the god's love. The mortals are all feminine in their charms, if not entirely female, and in terms of whether love is fortunate for them or not, or even merely benign, they are batting close to 500, a figure that is beyond excellent in baseball, but dicier in other realms. Io, the victim of both love and jealousy, is turned into a starving, wandering heifer, stung mad by a gadfly sent by Jupiter's jealous wife. Europa is abducted to Crete by Jupiter in the guise of a bull, and without too much extraordinary suffering, she bears his royal children. Ganymede, a handsome young prince who catches Jupiter's fancy, is delivered to Olympus by an eagle in order to become a sort of sommelier to the gods. Callisto, another victim of sexual jealousy, is turned into a bear, then mercifully placed among the stars to avoid being shot by her own son. In so many tales of romantic love, beauty casts spells that are often greeted or countered by other spells. In myth, Jupiter's moons have lives of deformity and transplant, and in science, the moons themselves are known for their erratic orbits. How like the characters of Alice Munro. Though her protagonists are not explicitly turned into animals or cupbearers or loved by any actual omnipotent tempestuous god, the wanderings, transformations, mischief, and anguish of possessive love, the kind of love everyone really values, the one nobody wants to have missed out on, according to the narrator of Hard Luck Stories, are her most abiding subjects. Like the ancient Greeks, Alice Munro has always known this is where the stories are. Fate, power, gender and class, human nature, mortal strength and divine frailty, all show up there to be negotiated and expressed. "Life would be grand if it weren't for the people," says a Munro character in Labor Day Dinner, who also offers up the line perhaps most often quoted from this collection, that love is not kind or honest, and does not contribute to happiness in any reliable way. It is an acerbic balance to the alkaline lilt of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4, also quoted in this story, which informs us that love suffereth long and is kind. That both ideas can be held simultaneously within the same narrative universe is part of the reason Munro's work endures. Its wholeness of vision, its complexity of feeling, its tolerance of mind. For the storyteller, the failure of love is irresistible in its drama, as is its brief happy madness, its comforts and vain griefs. And no one has brought greater depth of concentration and notice to the subject than Munro. No one has saturated her work with such startling physical observation and psychological insight. "He knew he had an advantage," she writes in Connection, the book's inaugural story. "And we had reached the point in our marriage where no advantage was given up easily." And in the final story, "You touch a man that way to remind him that you are grateful. It made me feel older than grandchildren would to see my daughter touch a man, a boy, this way. I felt her sad jitters, could predict her supple attentions." The style in which people circle one another, their mix of lunacy and hard intelligence, the manner in which our various pasts revolve simultaneously around the present, the way that children are always in a parent's gravitational pull, even when out of sight, The fact that filial love has an infinitude of stories, all these are signaled by the book's title and in the title story. I found my father in the heart wing, it begins, and the very many things it can mean to be a daughter are echoed through three generations gathered in that wing. Monroe brings both a warm eye and a cool eye to the project of loss. I saw how the forms of love might be maintained with a condemned person, but with the love, in fact, measured and disciplined, because you have to survive. Survival is often the hilarious miracle of Monroe's world. The harsh and mythic Canadian frontier has changed. It has found some retaliatory energy, encroached upon the home and riven it, in changing social times, making a frontier of family life. And yet Monroe is often joyous and funny, and this book is full not just of darkly jokey accident, but the voices of women often quite literally singing White Christmas in the vivid and gritty The Turkey Season, Row, Row, Row Your Boat in the haunted Connection, in the garden in Accident. Women stand on their heads, make love in supply closets, gut turkeys with their bare hands. They are amused and amazed by their own journeys and landing places. A weave of surprise and inevitability in the destination more often favors surprise. "Aren't we home?" are the last words of Labor Day dinner. "She has a way to go yet," concludes Accident. Monroe's women may brood over their choices, which loneliness might have better suited them, which alliance might have best preserved the self. "I think of being an old maid in another generation," begins Bardenbus. "There are plenty of old maids in my family. I come of straitened people, madly secretive, tenacious, economical. Like them, I could make a little go a long way." But in the end, there are powers beyond them that trump even the fierce will of the willful. The transits and upheaved settings of Monroe's stories make the formation of a character's life a bit catch-as-catch-can. A term it's possible to imagine is neither a fishing phrase nor a wrestling stance, but, as a friend of mine likes to insist, the very name of a place in Canada. In The Moons of Jupiter, first published in 1982, Monroe began a transition to a kind of story that was less linear, more layered with the pentimento of memory, a narrative able to head through and into time, forward or backward, pulling in somewhere as a car might do simply to turn around. "These are the haphazard migrations of life and love," she seems to say, "and the theme of accident, happy or unhappy, or both, or neither, is something she revisits in story after story. In Accident, the protagonist and her lover have their affair exposed when his son is killed sledding behind an automobile. That this is the man she eventually marries seems simultaneously cheaply arbitrary and fatefully expensive. It has transformed her life and others, and yet not. She's had her love, her scandal, her man, her children, but inside she's ticking away all by herself, the same Frances who was there before any of it. The girl written forever within the woman, the childish script of adult romantic love, the incomplete life transitions trapped fast in psychic amber. These are part of Monroe's presentation of the human palimpsest, and these layerings help begin the more structurally daring stories for which she has, starting with this thrilling, magnificent collection, Become Renowned. 2006. Shakespeare, the modern Elizabethan. An academic colleague of mine once asked me who had made me into a writer. "And I don't mean one of those creative writing professors," he said to me, "a creative writing professor." "Well, who do you mean?" I asked, probably ungrammatically, a thing creative writing professors get to do. "I mean, who was your Shakespeare professor?" he asked. He was, of course, a Shakespeare professor himself. I understood what he meant. Shakespeare was elemental, formative, fateful. Unlike the work of any writer before or since, Shakespeare's plays and poetry, while taking advantage of an audience's church-acquired tolerance for long speeches, celebrated the relatively new language of English and explored the strangeness within the ordinary and the familiar within the strange, the task of every artist. He returned again and again to the pathologies of love, marriage, and family, interest in which is a prerequisite for embarkation on an American literary life. My own Shakespeare professor, now a fellow at the Folger Library, was a brilliant, handsome, manic young man, fairly fresh from Duke, who on the first day of class sang an entire verse of Afternoon Delight, clutching the lectern with bitter energy, to demonstrate to the students the all-pervasive and maddening junk he, as a Shakespearean, had been up against all summer. He once diagrammed Hamlet as a sort of Pollock painting, with color-coded chalk for the characters. He directed us in a homemade film of Romeo and Juliet, The Capulets in Red Pennies. But in general, he simply, convincingly communicated his love of the work and helped the plays come alive. When asked by prospective students how a major in English prepared one for the real world, he did not mouth platitudes about languages or learning to think critically. He headed straight for Antony and Cleopatra. When you are surrounded by enemy armies and your generals tell you one thing and your girlfriend tells you something else, listen to your generals. English literature teaches you that. When I recently met him again in Washington, he said with unsuppressed glee, "How long are you in town for? The Queen's folio is here." Though many people have tried to insist that Shakespeare must have been a secret guild of theatricals, or the Earl of Oxford, or Sir Walter Raleigh, or some other person of education and rank, how about the theory that Shakespeare is really Cliff Robertson, joked a friend of mine, there is no doubt the man existed. Those who are still skeptical may be the same people who, generally pessimistic about human ability, insist that the pyramids were built by space aliens, or that Joyce Carol Oates is really a committee of middle-aged men. Or else they are the same elitists who think things like the roots of rock and roll are actually white. It seems clear, or at least we can say with a certain ad hoc confidence, that Shakespeare was born in Stratford-upon-Avon 442 years ago today, the son of a Catholic mother and glove-maker father. Christopher Marlowe, his contemporary, was the son of a shoemaker. Anyone got a problem with that? He had one sister who lived into adulthood and who may or may not have been the thwarted genius of Virginia Woolf's imagining. What would have happened had Shakespeare had a wonderfully gifted sister called Judith, she wrote. What we do know, however, is that his sister was named not Judith, but Joan. He also had three younger brothers, all of whom preceded him in death. Shakespeare's eighth-grade education was enough to give him a good grasp of Latin, to help him land work, perhaps, as a legal assistant. The plays are full of knowledge of the law, as well as of gloves. A tutor, a horseholder, and an actor. How many writers have had jobs like these? A lot. According to Stephen Greenblatt's impressive biography, Will in the World, Shakespeare's father's success, then failure in the glove business, may have prevented Shakespeare from going on to Oxford or Cambridge, as many of his classmates, and Christopher Marlowe, did. But this is not the same as an insistence that he was too uneducated to have written the plays. In Elizabethan England, apprentices abounded, as did pages and tutors, and Shakespeare would have easily made his way in that world. Actors had to know how to speak as gentlemen or bums and carried around their own costumes and swords. The art and value of disguise, impersonation, and adaptation are usually learned young. The father's mercantile life would have given the young son an early, indelible glimpse of all segments of society, rich and poor, rural and urban, successful and failed, and arguably gave Will, in part, the great comic character Falstaff. the drunken father figure whom the successful young man outgrows, outpaces, and renounces, though not without a chilling soupçon of hate. Shakespeare married early, and for practical reasons, someone older and richer. Where there's a will, Anne Hathaway, the old quip goes, and then left her behind to pursue revolutionary work in the world, only to return and take up companionship with her at the end. In this, and in his stalwart determination, knack for real estate, and penchant for petty lawsuits, he is reminiscent, to me, of George Washington, whose marriage was made similarly coolly, and which for a good part of his life sat at that same convenient and pleasing distance until retirement, while he annoyed the other army officers in New Jersey by dancing with their wives. That Shakespeare's most passionate loves were at first youthful and then adulterous is suggested by his plays, which scarcely have a happy marriage in them, let alone a happy family. Though one shouldn't look to fictional work as autobiography, a writer will always write from what is on his mind, and somewhat from what he knows, and so the intensity and buffoonery of youthful erotic love and the low, miserable hum of marital discontent, famous as literary muses, were probably Shakespeare's muses as well, just as they were Charles Dickens's, another actor-turned-writer, and Edith Wharton's, and remain Alice Munro's. The limberness of Shakespeare's gift is arguably best demonstrated not by the greatest plays, Hamlet, King Lear, Macbeth, but by two that are considered more minor, one a tragedy, one a comedy, and both written the same year, more likely the tragedy first, as the comedy is something of a satire on the tragedy. These are Romeo and Juliet and A Midsummer Night's Dream. That they might have been accruing simultaneously on his writing table is one of those events writers and critics alike are fond of imagining. Comedy equals tragedy plus time. Though they each have their various textual sources, Shakespeare, like Puccini, was a notorious artistic poacher, so much so that tales of Shakespeare's actual poaching of game have attached themselves to his legend, they are distinctly Shakespearean in their look at love. In Romeo and Juliet, however inconvenient Cupid's choice, the energy of youthful love hurdles obstacles. "With love's light wings did I o'erperch these walls," says Romeo to Juliet, adding, "and what love can do, that dares love attempt." Though at play's end, he is dead from his own hand, as is Juliet, victims in their own plot to outsmart the rather vicious society around them. Impetuosity never had a greater poet or a greater dramatist, or a greater comedian. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, a kind of buddy tale of mind and body on a faded forest trudge, erotic love is quite literally a drug, defying all solemnity and even intelligence, washing the brain in potions, something modern scientists have at long last proven to be an accurate occurrence. The most beautiful creature of the forest is made to fall in love with a blustery bumpkin by the sad name of Bottom, who through fairy mischief is now sporting the head of, well, an ass. A donkey's head. This is grotesquery worthy of a Tim Burton movie, and it is all in service of Shakespeare's compassionate skepticism about love. Each of these plays contains the other. A Midsummer Night's Dream contains Romeo and Juliet in its enactment of the tragical tale of Pyramus and Thisbe, but played for laughs. "These yellow cowslip cheeks are gone, lovers make moan, his eyes were green as leeks." And Romeo and Juliet contains a window onto A Midsummer Night's Dream in the comic relief of Romeo's friend Mercutio, who throws barbs at the mere idea of romantic love to the comic approval of his entourage. "Prick love for pricking and you beat love down." The structure of both these plays is intricate and geometrical. A Midsummer Night's Dream moves easily in a single day among four different worlds, and among the various romances giddily proceeding within them, some with more elegance than others. At the end of Romeo and Juliet, the body count perfectly, symmetrically comprises 2 Montagues, 2 Capulets, and 2 relatives of the prince. Death, not love, has the final blocking. Though, of course, there is always the curtain call, and everyone is back up and alive again, as if to keep trying. Oh, why not? Shakespeare's London was one of the great cities of Europe, though smaller than Madison, Wisconsin is today. It was also rife with the religious bloodshed of modern Belfast or Baghdad. When Shakespeare arrived in London as a young man, he would have passed, impaled on the famous bridge into town, the skull of a distant cousin, killed for being a Catholic. How could this fail to leave an impression? He filled his early plays written in his new home with violent young men and angry mobs. When he left, rich and successful, it was to die at 52 of what doctors today have speculated was a rare cancer of the tear duct, an illness as cruelly ironic as Puccini's cancer of the throat. His beloved Globe Theater had burned down. He could not have been happy. But he did not know that his work would survive forever, not just on stage, but in book, screen, and musical form. No one at that time could have. Or that his words would inspire their own honoring thefts. Joni Mitchell took a glittering simile of his for that song about the Midway. West Side Story and She's the Man borrowed his plots. Washington, Dickens, Puccini, and Tim Burton somehow merged into one. There's your genius, or the bare-barred bones of him. Add a dash of Ogden Nash. 2006. One Hot Summer, or A Brief History of Time. A bride on her summer honeymoon. What could be more beguiling? Well, a younger bride to begin with. One less destined to wear an off-white suit at the ceremony. And what's with that, anyway? The advertising of a lady's past, the beige and ivory taint of autobiography, dyed like a scarlet A into the very threads of her dress. Why not say it another way, and wear yellow, black, or green? Why not horizontal stripes? Chinese brides wore red, as did Jane Austen's mother, who later cut up her attire for outfits for the kids. Who wouldn't want something actually bright and cuttable? I had always had a little trouble with anything called an institution. I was 34 and had been seeing the same man for 4 consecutive years and living with him for 2. Not a record for anyone, except for him. We spent the spring fretting. Should we get married? He felt we should, in this moving through life way. It was what came next. Which would in turn, of course, quickly introduce the idea of divorce. We are all fiends for narrative, plot, rising action. I wondered whether our marrying should really be this notch in the belt of time. Shouldn't it be, rather, an emotional and spiritual referendum on us? If we needed an event, we could say, break up, get married, or break up. That's pretty much what it came down to. Love? Love went without saying, so we didn't say it. Perhaps we were a little bored, something we both seemed to agree should probably occur. Though looking back, I'm not sure why. It was just motion, momentum. But with the tulips up, the air warming, and then suddenly the tulips down, petalless, bug-like, and leaning, still we remained undecided. We both understood I would not change my name to his. But privately, I felt this might not augur well for the success of our union. I suspected, quite correctly, I think now, that those women who changed their names to match their husbands understood something about marriage that I was in the dark about. My boyfriend was of the school of thought that marriage, like a house or a car, was a necessary accoutrement of adulthood. I was resistant to that school of thought. And wasn't really in any school of thought at all, not a certified one, not in a matriculated way, To quote Daniel Handler's adverbs, I was letting my thoughts run around the yard rather than reporting inside. Or to quote from Richard Yates's The Best of Everything, a familiar little panic gripped her. She couldn't marry him. She hardly even knew him. Sometimes it occurred to her